Hello, I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. These lectures are part of the Great Courses on Tape series. The Great Courses on Tape cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. The lectures on these tapes are titled Classics of American Literature, Part 4. The lecturer is Professor Arnold Weinstein. Professor Weinstein received his undergraduate degree in Romance Languages from Princeton University in 1962. He studied at the University of Paris in 1960-61 and at the Free Universität in Berlin in 1962-63. He received his master's and doctorate in comparative literature from Harvard University in 1964 and 1968, respectively. Dr. Weinstein has been teaching courses on European, English, and American literature at Brown University since 1968. He has been the chairperson of the Advisory Council on Comparative Literature at Princeton University and is actively involved in the American Comparative Literature Association. He has received many academic honors, research grants, and fellowships. In 1983, he was visiting professor of American literature at Stockholm University, where he received the Fulbright Senior Lecturer Award. He is currently a member of the Academy of Literary Studies and the director of a National Endowment for the Humanities-funded program in Great Books. In 1995, he was named Brown University's Best Teacher in the Humanities. He is the recipient of a National Endowment for the Humanities Award for University Teachers for 1998 to 1999 for his work in literature and medicine. Dr. Weinstein is the author of Vision and Response in Modern Fiction, Fictions of the Self, 1550 to 1800, The Fiction of Relationship, and Nobody's Home, Self, Speech, and Place in American Fiction from Hawthorne to DeLillo. He is working in the fields of literature and medicine with a view toward a book-length study of the relationship between the two. Each of Professor Weinstein's lectures is outlined in the course guide that accompanies these tapes. The course guide also includes a glossary, timeline, biographical notes, and bibliography. You may find it useful to review the outlines before and after listening to the lectures. Lecture 37, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, American Paradise Regained.
This is Lecture 37, and it's the first of five lectures on Mark Twain. Twain is, in all senses of the word, the freshest writer, probably, in the American canon. He's fresh in the sense of impudence, too. He brings to American literature something of the vigor and spirit and rambunctiousness, really, of Southwestern humor. And it challenges the piety and the sort of stolid nature of New England writing. He really crashes a party. And yet he becomes a kind of homemade New England citizen later in his life, once he is established. He's left us with probably our most famous stories about American childhood, certainly American boyhood, so that Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn are household terms in American thinking. We'll want to think about what kind of stories these are. They're not alike at all. People don't read Tom Sawyer much anymore. Now there are reasons why people don't read Huckleberry Finn, and I'll get into that. In my lectures, I'm going to talk about the general career today and talk about Tom Sawyer, then spend three lectures focusing on the great masterpiece, which is Huckleberry Finn, and then close with a commentary on a really odd text, which is one of my favorites, which is Pudd'nhead Wilson. There's a lot of variety in Twain, more than one would think. And I think in his dealing with issues of childhood, he's also dealing with issues of innocence. He's dealing with issues of nostalgia. He's dealing with a number of American myths that are not really only found in his own work. There are reasons why we have enshrined these books, like Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. So on the one hand, I'm going to suggest that there's something escapist and censored about Twain. That was part of his own marriage condition, too. I mean, he was this woman, Livy, whom he married, whom he loved very, very much, came from a more established, proper Victorian kind of background. And everything he wrote, she would sort of approve of or disapprove of. She acted really as an in-house censor, cleaned up his language, etc. And it's the case that these books often skirt issues of violence and terror and sexuality and adult themes. There's a very famous contention made by the American literary critic, Leslie Fiedler, that all of the great American literature belongs on the children's shelf, that American literature is somehow congenitally unable to deal with adult themes. And Fiedler goes on to say that there's no great American novel about mature sexuality, that it just doesn't happen. Instead, it gets either translated into issues of guilt and repression, as in Hawthorne, or it gets elided out of the text altogether, and you write about children instead, as in Twain. Or you write a book about men on a whaling boat, as Melville. Tom Sawyer, which is where I want to begin, is our quintessential romance, and Tom is the eternal child. At the age of 71, Twain said, "It is a pity we cannot escape from life when we are young." And, of course, at 71, it's a good time to be saying that. "It's a pity we cannot escape from life when we are young." Tom Sawyer, I think, represents a very powerful streak in American thinking, which is not to grow up, to be a boy forever. We've seen this as far back as Rip Van Winkle, one of the earliest texts that we looked at, about the advantages in somehow refusing a number of things, marriage, sexuality, responsibility, seeking refuge, seeking out, seeking freedom. You could read Walden that way, as Thoreau's opting out as well as moving into nature. Think of Sherwood Anderson. Think of Ernest Hemingway. Think of William Faulkner. Think of J.D. Salinger. Many of our books are about young people, usually boys, almost always boys, clearing out, trying to preserve a kind of innocence, refusing to grow up, refusing to enter into that covenant, that contract, with a soiled or perhaps scary world. You don't have this in Europe. This is a quintessential American theme. We have picaresque literature. The picaro is a figure who is a rogue and a scoundrel and on the outside, and that's a tradition that does loom large in American literature. You could read Huckleberry Finn as a picaresque novel. But the picaro doesn't choose this. And I think it's partly because European writers start with the view that no one can opt out. Opting out is the fiction. You were born into culture. You're born into class relations. American writers, and I think Americans in general, don't particularly want to believe that. They want to believe that there could be some sort of inchoate freedom apart from society. You could clear out. That's what Walden is about. To get out of the arrangements of Concord and go into the woods. It's what the adventure stories, as I say, that's what Nick Adams wants to do in Hemingway's stories. It's what Ike McCaslin wants to do in Go Down Moses or The Bear. It's what Holden Caulfield wants to do. So it's an enduring American dream of sorts to be clear of the arrangements of culture. But I think it's something that each of the books that talks about it tests it, challenges it. Well, Tom Sawyer, of course, is the quintessential prankster, the trickster, the bad boy who is so lovable and irresistible. And he is particularly talented for avoiding work, having fun, but getting results anyway. One of the most famous scenes in American mythology is the famous whitewashing sequence in Tom Sawyer. I'll read that to you. You recall his job, of course, his chore is to whitewash the fence, but he figures out a way to have everybody else do it for him. There was no lack of material. Boys happened along every little while. They came to jeer, but remained to whitewash. By the time Ben was fagged out, Tom had traded the next chance to Billy Fisher for a kite in good repair. And when he played out, Johnny Miller brought in a dead rat and a string to swing it with, and so on, hour after hour. And when the middle of the afternoon came, from being a poor, poverty-stricken boy in the morning, Tom was literally rolling in wealth. He had, besides the things mentioned already, 12 marbles, part of a Jew's harp, a piece of blue bottled glass to look through, a spool cannon, a key that wouldn't unlock anything, a fragment of chalk, a glass stopper of a decanter, a tin soldier, a couple of tadpoles, 6 firecrackers, a kitten with only one eye, a brass doorknob, a dog collar, but no dog, the handle of a knife, 4 pieces of orange peel, and a dilapidated old window sash. That's quite a treasure trove he's picked up there. Well, you know, it's been said, and it's totally right, that this is, Ben Franklin is turning over in his grave. This is the entire undoing of the American work ethos. It pays not to work and to have other people do your work for you. And if you're shrewd and smart and clever, you can make that happen. There's a whole sort of earnest schema of labor being noble and of sweat being the ticket to success that is being, I think, cashiered here. It's being turned over. And I think that that's important. I think that that's part of the fun and games of this book. Twain is always in love with con men of one sort or another. He thinks performance matters for him. If you can trick other people into doing your work for you, all the better. Now, what does succeed in Twain? Well, you know, what Tom does is he plays hooky, for example. And it's a phrase that no one uses anymore. There was a time when I was a child that was considered quite a bold thing to do, not to go to school. He looks for buried treasure. Let's look at the forms of adventure here. He sneaks a smoke. Well, today, actually, that's becoming dangerous again with our anti-tobacco culture. But for a while, that was thought pretty tame also. He slips out of Aunt Polly's. He gets into scuffles. Twain is wonderful at the kind of sort of two roosters eyeing each other when he comes across a new boy in the block. Conversations like this. They just sort of move around each other. I can lick you. I'd like to see you try it. Well, I can do it. No, you can't either. Yes, I can. No, you can't. I can. You can't. Can't. And it will go on for a page or two. We've all been there. We've seen that sort of thing. Twain really knows that. He's got his finger on that particular pulse. And yet, how sensible is this today? How credible is this today in a culture where you don't let your children out on the streets alone, much less have them encountering strange kids where they're doing this sort of circling dance? That our society has become so much more threatening and so much more frightening. We know so much more about the terrible things out there, and they're not in the form of some other kid that might get in a scuffle with our kid. It's a much more predatory society. You could go wrong in much worse ways. Twain looks very, very, very quaint to us. That's part of the nostalgia while we read him. We read him to access an age of innocence of sorts, a return to something that we don't have anymore. Pranks, playing hooky, sneaking a smoke. And yet, the question has to be also, who was Twain writing for? Who is he writing for? Who would enjoy Twain? Would readers of color enjoy Twain? Do women readers always enjoy Twain? Aren't these stories always stories of boys' escapades, boys' adventures? What would a young girl find in reading Tom Sawyer or Huckleberry Finn? And what about Tom Sawyer? What kind of a playful fellow is he? We're going to see, particularly this will be more evident in Huckleberry Finn, he's remarkably bookish. All of his pranks and tricks are played by the book. He has read a lot. He's really Twain's version of Don Quixote. He lives according to the stories that he's read. So that everything that he knows about pirates and ransom and finding treasure, it's chapter and verse in the stories that he's read. This is what you're supposed to do. He gets his gang to work with him. He helps makes others share his belief in these things. But there's something very formulaic about it. He sees reality through the prism, through the lenses of the established stories that he's read. This is a non-problem in Tom Sawyer. You'll see that it becomes quite a problem in Huckleberry Finn. So why did Twain write this book? What was the point of writing this? He wrote it in 1876. And at that point, he is a wealthy, celebrated writer, a very established writer. He's living at that point in his Victorian mansion, kind of monstrous place, that he himself built in Hartford, Connecticut, which was the wealthiest per capita city in the United States at that time. He's surrounded by very, very distinguished people. Harriet Beecher Stowe is his neighbor. Charles Dudley Warner is his neighbor. For a wild man from the Southwest, this is quite an established position he has. He's recognized as the great American humorist, and he has sort of carte blanche for his wonderful sort of witticisms. He is a friend of the rich and famous. A lot of the great American industrialists of the late 19th century, Twain was on close terms with. Someone once criticized his benefactor, the Standard Oil magnate Henry Rogers, as possessing tainted money. And Twain said, 'Tis twice tainted. Taint yours and taint mine. I said he's fresh. He's the freshest writer in the tradition. He's got a comeback, a witticism, before you can even turn your head. He's capable of phrases like the calm confidence of a Christian with four aces. That's the sort of, he loves to sort of mix his registers. This man grew up in the South, and he brings Southwestern humor, which is rollicking, wild, and fierce, ferocious stuff. There are characters like Sut Lovingood and Simon Suggs and Davy Crockett, not the guy that we've seen in our TV series, but a much fiercer Davy Crockett. And people loved reading these stories. These were wild, horrible kinds of stories. There are terrible scrapes with Indians, with slaves. There's a lot of butchery that goes on in these stories. Lots of violence, much racism, a lot of ugliness, but a lot of raw humor as well, and a lot of sort of vitriolic sort of energy that was never available to polite New England literature. Frontier culture. And Twain is the conduit for a lot of that. That's what he sort of channels in to American literature. He mainstreams it. He's exactly the right person for it. He grew up in the South in Hannibal, Missouri. And he revisits this South. He revisits it in Tom Sawyer. He revisits it in Huckleberry Finn. He revisits it in Pudd'nhead Wilson. We know that one of his seminal early experiences was being a pilot on riverboats. Those years come back as well. And his love and his knowledge of the Mississippi is critical in his very lovely text, Life on the Mississippi. You must know that in the 1870s, the states such as Ohio and Missouri and Arkansas were considered the West. So this is the frontier. But Twain himself actually goes west. He goes to California. He becomes a silver miner. He's a freelance correspondent. And so that's why I say he's the natural conduit for all of these frontier humors, these veins of sort of raw folk humor, folk tale. So this is the kind of rough, fresh, brazen, inelegant, rowdy, sassy tidings that he brings to American literature. He crashes, as I said, the New England party. He has been rightly called the Lincoln of our literature. He's plain spoken in that sense. He doesn't have any aristocratic frills to him at all. Some of his early stories are entirely in this humoristic vein, the celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, or The Innocents Abroad, which was one of his early bestsellers. In The Innocents Abroad, Innocents, I-N-N-O-C-E-N-T-S, a bunch of Americans who go to Europe. It's the great spoof on tourism. It's as true today as it was then. It calls the bluff on Europe, even though it expresses in a kind of very important American hunger for Europe. But these Americans are shrewd. They're suspicious. The Europeans are probably, frauding them in some way. There's something bogus about what they're seeing. They're being bamboozled. And so it's a caustic book. It looks at the European parade through the caustic images of America. It's like democracy all of a sudden observing the behavior, the antics of class. So in this story, the narrator, for example, can't ever keep exchange rates in his mind. He goes crazy trying to figure out what his dollars are worth. Or he can't make him understood in restaurants. How many of us have ever had that experience in Europe? And that also irks the world out of him. He makes a lot of Philistine wisecracks. He has his own view of Europe that is Twain's form of humor. For example, the information the ancients didn't have was very voluminous. Or they spell it V-I-N-C-I and pronounce it V-I-N-C-H-Y, Vinci. Foreigners always spell better than they pronounce. Or who is this Renaissance? Where did he come from? All right. Not really clever stuff, but part of the kind of put-down of Europe from the kind of no-nonsense American who thinks maybe they're trying to take advantage of me. Now, as I say, this is an important theme, this American innocence abroad, that this will be handled in a different way in Henry James with major dividends, that the great theme of sort of our education and the new lost generation is unthinkable without this, of Americans going to Europe to complete their moral as well as their cultural education. That happens. What about this? Why would you choose this lens of innocence? Something that we've seen a lot of already. Benito Cereno only makes sense when you think of Melville's choice to tell this story about slavery and about mutiny through the naive eyes of an innocent American sea captain. And I think that Benito Cereno is an extraordinarily prophetic story, that it tells us about the likelihood that we might misconstrue other cultures and not understand them. And I think there are a number of misadventures in American history where we may have been in cultural situations that we couldn't read. We didn't know how to map. Well, that's the way Melville plays it. He moves in that tragic direction, it seems to me. But for Twain, it's a formula for humor. It's a formula for a kind of look at the apparent sophistication of Europe through the unjaundiced eyes of Americans who are not going to be fooled. It also is written at a time where there's a great craving for innocence. Twain himself coined the phrase the Gilded Age. This is the decade after the Civil War. There's been a lot of carnage, a lot of destruction. And there's a sense in which you can see in a lot of American texts a yearning to go back to childhood, to go back to innocence. This is the time of the Uncle Remus stories, to go back to a fable about race relations that is much more consoling, not a fable of conflict, but a fable of understanding, of older black people being sort of uncle-like figures. Or the Horatio Alger stories, the story of the American who can become just a street urchin at the beginning and then become president at the end. Or Louisa May Alcott's Little Women, the same sort of interest in telling the story of young people going back to an age of innocence, to use Wharton's title. So you will have idealized representations of characters by Twain. Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn are our favorite pair of naughty boys. They are the ragamuffins. They smoke, they curse a little bit, but they have hearts of gold. Now, Twain wrote Tom Sawyer, as I said, in 1876. The sequel to it, Huckleberry Finn, took him 10 years to write. And during that time, a lot of things happened to him. That in 1880, Twain, who was a kind of inveterate bad investor, loses over $190,000 by investing in the Page typesetter. He's convinced this is going to be the wake of... He's almost right, too. I mean, but nonetheless, he loses fortune several times in his life. He also has great financial reverses in the 1890s. And that's the time when he becomes this spellbinding public lecturer and goes all over the country, partly to pay off these debts when he goes bankrupt, that he has this honor code that says he should pay them off. So Huckleberry Finn comes about only in 1885, 10 years later. Puddenhead Wilson is in 1894. At this time, Twain by now is a world celebrity. He receives honorary degrees in Oxford and places like that. But his life turns increasingly bitter and sour in the late years. His daughter Susie dies in 1896 when he's in Europe. He never forgets himself for that. And his wife Livy dies in 1904. He becomes very cynical, bitter. He writes, his writing sort of really dries up. He writes these fragments that he can't complete in his late years, diatribes, angry about America, loses his confidence in this country, and he dies pretty much a bitter, broken man in 1910. So Tom Sawyer is very much the early phase of Twain. This is the safety net of romance. Tom is a rebel. Huck is alienated. We know they're going to end up okay. No one ever has any doubts that these kids could really get into trouble. All these pranks are not serious. That wouldn't have to be the case. You could get lost in a cave. They oversee murders and things like that. You really could get killed. Won't happen in this story, obviously. But they flirt with it. These are strategies for flirting. Tom at one point says that he would like to die temporarily. And sort of what he does, because remember that he goes to the island with Huck and they think he's dead, and then they sneak back and they watch their own funeral ceremony? That is, those are the trumps of art. I mean, in a sense, that's what Dickinson is doing in a different vein. But that's sort of, it's a way of sort of sidling around it rather than actually encountering it. It's a screened world of sorts. This story takes place, I'm sorry, in the 1840s. We hear nothing about the Mexican War. We hear nothing about the debate on slavery, which is becoming a strident debate already then between Northerners and Southerners at that time in America. That's factored out. He doesn't want that into this book. You'll see that that comes in with a vengeance in Huckleberry Finn. But St. Petersburg in Tom Sawyer is an idol. Twain said that Tom Sawyer was, quote, simply a hymn put into prose form to give it a worldly air. This is American innocence retrieved. But the question is, how innocent is it? And can you write a totally innocent book? Sex, for example, is it really screened out of these adolescents? We know certainly this kind of book wouldn't interest young readers today because it seems to be too impossibly pure. And yet, Becky Thatcher in this book, she sneaks a look at the naked anatomical drawings in her teacher's book. She pulls out the page. It's one of the key moments. she has the curiosity that all youngsters have. How does the body work? She's got one herself. It's beginning to change. The relationship between Tom and Becky is the book's predominant romance. And at first, it's just done in terms of games and little sort of tricks that they play on each other and little sort of bouts of anger where one says something and the other won't forgive them. But when this book moves into high gear and you have the sequence of Tom and Becky in the cave, something important happens. And likewise, when Tom lies for Becky, you may remember, she tears the page of the book with the drawing. The teacher discovers this, and it's one of those countdowns. Who in this room has torn my book? And when it finally gets to Becky, and Tom looks at her, and she's quivering, and she's getting ready to faint, he speaks up and says, I done it. And it's a high moment in the book. It's a moment of courage. Well, the cave sequence is really interesting. I mean, it has Poe-like elements in it. It's sort of mythological in its own way. These two people are lost in a dark cave, and that cave is described really as a labyrinth. MacDougall's cave was but a vast labyrinth of crooked aisles that ran into each other and out again and led nowhere. It was said one might wander days and nights together through its intricate tangle of rifts and chasms and never find the end of the cave, and that he might go down and down and still down. This is no longer a child writer. This is a writer who's finding his rhythms and finding his material. Down and down and still down into the earth. And it was just the same. Labyrinth underneath labyrinth and no end to any of them. No man knew the cave. That was an impossible thing. So that this is an exploratory text. And in that cave where they are lost for 3 days and three nights, that is the initiation passage of the book. That's when the romance is going to be born between this boy and this girl. They will become adults in some sense. There's language that suggests the kind of nascent sexuality in it, that we hear of stalactites, the length and circumference of a man's leg, for example. So that Twain is sort of getting the body into this cave sequence. They think they're going to die. They don't think anyone is ever going to find them. And the idea of being lost in a cave and dying, never coming out, being lost in the labyrinth, this picks up old, old motifs of Theseus in the labyrinth, the play Phaedra that Racine wrote, that Euripides wrote before that, of somehow being lost here in the dark where no one can see you, becomes also an image of sexual freedom, and this is the moment where the love sort of is born between them. Tom more or less says he wanted to stay here. When Becky says, my God, you know, you didn't make any marks, like the Hansel and Gretel story, to find your way out, Tom says, Becky, I was such a fool. I never thought we might want to come back. No, I can't find the way. It's all mixed up. It is all mixed up. The Twain is working other things in this. He's trying to say something about, as I said, the maturation, about the desire between this young couple. I'm not trying to say this is a teenage sex story. It's not that at all. It's just that nonetheless, it has many motifs. They pull out a piece of food that he's saved, and he says to her, do you remember this? And she almost smiles. She says, it's our wedding cake, Tom. Yes, I wish it was as big as a barrel, for it's all we've got. I saved it from the picnic for us to dream on, Tom, the way grown-up people do with wedding cake. But it'll be our funeral cake, the cake at the wake. And then she starts to weep. And at the end, we see the two of them. He consoles her. How long afterward it was that Becky came to a slow consciousness that she was crying in Tom's arms, neither could tell. So that we see the molding of the couple. We see what this writer can do under certain circumstances. Sexuality is not the only thing that is indirectly brought into this text. This text has its poetic resonances elsewhere, too. Violence is in this text, even though we know nothing's going to happen to these people. And the figure of violence is the legendary Injun Joe. This would be a reason, too, why the book would be censored today. Native Americans would have a lot against it. Injun Joe is a figure of pure rage and anger. He has been humiliated earlier, and that's the revenge he wants. He wants to get even with folks. 5 years ago, you drove me away from your father's kitchen one night. When I come to ask for something to eat, and you said I weren't there for any good. And when I swore I'd get even with you, even if it took 100 years, your father had me jailed for a vagrant. Do you know, I think I'd forget. Injun blood ain't in me for nothing. Now I've got you, and you're going to settle. And the same is true. He's mad at Widow Douglas. Injun Joe, and he wants to get her the same way. And he almost does. And he explains why. Her husband was rough on me. Many times he was rough on me. And mainly he was the justice of the peace that jugged me for vagrant. That ain't all. It ain't a millionth part of it. He had me horsewhipped. Horsewhipped in front of a jail like a nigger. All the town looking on. Horsewhipped. You understand? He took advantage of me and died. But I'll take it out on her. Oh, don't kill her. Kill? Who said anything about killing? I'd kill him if he were here, not her. When you want to get revenge on a woman, you don't kill her. Bosh. You go for her looks. You slit her nostrils. You notch her ears like a sow. It's pretty fierce, violent stuff, what he wants to do. He won't be allowed to do it. When Tom and Huck talk about all of this, they think that they're making it up. Nobody. And you know what they say to him? Well, it's plain enough now. When you talk about notching ears and slitting noses, I judge that was your own embellishment, because white men don't take that sort of revenge. But an Injun? That's a different matter altogether. Racism is in here. Subspeciation is in here. Indians, blacks, they're not completely human. It's not going to be up front like it is in Huckleberry Finn, but Twain is delivering his culture in these sequences. At the end, as you know, Injun Joe is also in the cave, but unlike Tom and Becky, he doesn't get out. And his death, he's described in a very beautiful sequence when they finally come back after they know he's been there, because Tom tells them. When the cave door was unlocked, a sorrowful sight presented itself in the dim twilight of the place. Injun Joe lay stretched upon the ground, dead, with his face close to the crack of the door, as if his longing eyes had been fixed to the latest moment upon the light and cheer of the free world outside. He is the figure of the outsider. He is the marginalized person. He's the one who wants out and can't get out. He is the figure, then, who will later, I think, point to Nigger Jim, to the prisoners of culture, to the people who were not allowed to have their humanity. All of it gets cleaned up in this book. It works out as a kind of happy children's story. Tom is the hero of the story. Judge Thatcher at the end wants to send him to law school, which is probably where he's going to end up. He's going to become, this is the irresistible dream in Twain, he's going to become the town's number one citizen. There's a great dream of respectability, of finally being accepted by the fine folk. And Twain loves it. He can't resist it, even though he knows that he's fundamentally a performer himself, as is Tom, a performer. The other figure, of course, is Huck. Huck is pointed to all the time in this story as the person who is uncivilizable. He refuses to. He can't bear it. He can't bear living with people where he has to dress right, he has to eat meals at proper times, he can't smoke. That's totally, totally beyond him. As this book ends, Tom wants to civilize Huck. Says, you've got to behave right, otherwise you can't be in my gang, can't be in my group. Tom is going to be an agent of civilization. Tom has lied. He lied in school. He's the one who took up for Becky. He said, I done it. That lie in this book is somehow going to be transformed. Judge Thatcher says it was a lie, but it was a grand lie. It was a noble lie. It's going to get him into law school, that lie. A lie doesn't just get you into law school in Twain. When we get to Huckleberry Finn, we're going to see that lying is much more complicated, has much more at stake than anything here. But this is a prelude. This goes to point to what's coming. Thank you.